another moment in pop culture news that gave me some joy, actually.
Was it because it was Keanu Reeves' birthday?
Wait, whoa.
It was
hey,
like,
that's...
Sorry, I couldn't wait.
Jump in the gun, Ebony.
Hey, and welcome to Feminist Frequency Radio. This is episode 42. I'm your host, Ebony Astor, and I have been called off the bench to replace our normal starting quarterback, Anita Sarkeesian. To make sure I keep it in the lines, I'm joined by Carolyn. Just call me Coco. Everybody does.
Pet it.
Hey, Carol.
Don't ever call me Coco. I do not want to be called Coco.
Noted. This is the show that asks you to be critical of the media you love, or alternatively, we're the feminist killjoys coming for your media, depending on your perspective. Today's show is a twisting and turning Southern California journey into the mind via the 2001 David Lynch film Mulholland Drive. And as always, we'll finish the show by each sharing a little something in What's Your Freakout? Or, as I still say, in the quiet moments when I'm alone, what's your deal? Now, on with the show. Carol, how are you doing?
Yeah, pretty good. You know, it's Labor Day. It's a holiday.
Yeah, workers of the world unite.
Exactly. Yeah. So, you know, I'm looking forward to getting this podcast done and then enjoying some much deserved leisure time today.
Same.
Yeah.
Same.
Yeah.
Like, if I don't spend at least 2/3 of today napping, something will have gone radically wrong.
Yeah. Well, I believe you can do it, Ebony. I have faith in you.
I do too. And I have to say, I feel great about this plan because I have recently started running again.
Yeah, I saw you mention that somewhere.
Which is fantastic. And I mean, y'all know that, like, of all the sports that you can do, running is perhaps the smuggest, you know? Like, people who run cannot shut up about running. And I'm happy to join that elite crew. I got my miles in this morning. We're
nice.
Going to do this podcast. And then I'm going to nap for the gold this afternoon.
You know, I mean, naps after, you know, a run are just, they can just be so much more satisfying, I think, than just a, you know, run of the mill nap. So enjoy that.
I have earned it.
Exactly.
And I don't even, like, I don't need anything else to be happy today. But anyways, that's what's going on with my life. Me, you know, just shumbling. And when I say run, I mean, you know, slowly moonwalking down the sidewalk. Like, I'm not winning no medals here. And then napping on Labor Day.
Beautiful. Beautiful.
Yeah. Carol, hit me with some pop culture news.
All right. So, hey, I don't know if you remember, but there used to be this this famous stand-up comedian who had his own had his own television show that was, you know, widely acclaimed and beloved, named Louis C.K. or something.
The name sounds vaguely familiar.
Yeah. So, you know, he got in some trouble because he did awful things to women. And then he went away for a while. Like, by a while, I mean, like, 9 months, maybe. And then, you know, he's, like, hitting the stand-up, you know, the clubs again. He did a set. And so this has resulted, the reason I bring this up, is that this has resulted in a wide range of, you know, important, strong, like, pieces from women, including, you know, Roxane Gay, among, you know, many others, about, like, this idea of, this is, like, new territory for the Me Too movement, right? Is like, okay, now what? Like, because a lot of people have this expectation of, okay, well, now Louis C.K. went away for a while, like 9 months again. What else is he supposed to do? Like, is he supposed to live in obscurity and shame forever?
Yes.
Right. And, you know, and so now we're getting to this point where we have to sort of establish, like, look, there have literally been, like, no consequences for him. Like, you know, especially compared to the ways in which the careers and the lives of the women that, you know, he sort of abused, and, you know, or the women that other men in powerful positions have abused, you know, the way that their lives and careers can be derailed, can be, you know, there's been no reckoning with that for a man like Louis C.K. And so now it's that kind of awkward phase of figuring out, okay, well, now what, right? And but certainly the answer is certainly not oh, yeah, it's fine. It's time for him to come back out and, like, start having his career, you know.
Yeah, the answer is certainly not do a sneak appearance, you know, at a comedy show for which people were not prepared and for which people could symbolically, like, literally could not give their consent to be in the same room with this dude. I am mystified. Why am I lying? I'm not mystified because people continue to be trash day in and day out. But the idea that simply a certain amount of not even a very long period of time is sufficient for Louis C.K., the perpetrator of these heinous acts, but also all of the rest of us to have fully reckoned with what he has done. Like, I didn't need him back. No one needed him back. That, you know, like the argument that, you know, well, what do we, you know, and I think a lot of the conversations I was seeing anyway were kicked off by comedian Michael Ian Black's tweet about, like, hey, you know, let's have a conversation about what it's, you know, what it would take for someone to truly demonstrate that they've changed and, you know, for us to allow them back into the body politic. And people were like, no, let's talk about what it would take to bring these victims, you know, back into the fold. Like the perpetrator can stay on the sidelines for, you know, as long as we deem necessary. Just the dude has paid no consequences. He wasn't even gone a full year.
Yeah, and there's this sort of mindset, it seems, you know, among maybe men like Louis C.K. himself, or this, there seems to be, based on the way that he's behaving, is that we you know, that they're needed, that they're necessary, that we need him to come back at some point, right? But it's like we're doing fine without you. Like we actually don't need you to come back. Like we'll be okay.
Yeah, take some more time off. And yeah. That's the thing, you know, it would be one thing if in the intervening 9 months since this story broke, there had been sort of demonstrable change, like that we could point to. And I think that's necessary for, you know, like if these people want to come back into the public sphere, then there needs to be some sort of, you know, public reckoning with what they've done, right? And just the fact that that's not occurred, like simply sitting out for a bit is not enough. You know? And so I love the idea that, like, these dude bros who are, you know, coming out of pocket to support Louis C.K. On this, you know, like, does the guy have to, you know, sit out forever? You know, we're talking about people losing their livelihoods. Like, okay, first of all, that dude's a millionaire. He's going to be fine.
Yeah.
But as if the punishment of not being in the public eye is itself a consequence. You know, like as if Louis C.K. is entitled to our attention, and the fact that he is not allowed to have it, that we are not giving it to him, you know, somehow makes us villainous. You know, like we're being too punitive on this guy. Why are people like this? Louis C.K., go somewhere and hide.
Well, there you have it. Yeah. Another moment in pop culture news that gave me some joy, actually.
Was it because it was Keanu Reeves' birthday?
Wait, whoa.
It was
hey,
like,
that's.
Sorry, I couldn't wait.
Jump in the gun, Ebony. No, we're saving the best for last.
Okay.
We're saving the best for last. Before we get to that, so there was a, at festival, I think it was Telluride, I believe it was the Telluride Film Festival, there was a screening of the upcoming Neil Armstrong biopic, First Man, starring Ryan Gosling.
Oh, right.
Directed by Damien Chazelle of Whiplash and La La Land, and the reactions were pretty rapturous from critics at the festival. You know, people are saying that it's a really fantastic film, but Marco Rubio got.
I don't know why that set me off.
Yeah,
but.
Yeah. Got 13,000 retweets by tweeting. So it was word came from the festival screening that while the film does show the American flag that Armstrong planted on the moon at numerous times, it does not actually show the act of Armstrong planting the flag on the moon, right? And Marco Rubio tweeted. Again, this got 13,000 retweets. The fact that they don't show Armstrong planting the U.S. flag on the moon, he says, this is total lunacy and a disservice at a time when our people need reminders of what we can achieve when we work together. The American people paid for that mission on rockets built by Americans with American technology and carrying American astronauts. It wasn't a U.N. mission. And, you know, like, I think the film... yeah, right? Like, Ryan Gosling himself has said that... that he doesn't believe that Armstrong saw himself as like a purely kind of American hero. And, you know, and anyway, for my part, I'm like, I don't think we need images that could stoke nationalistic sentiments among viewers in our, you know, right now in our cinemas, not that, or never, we never need those. So to me, this sounds like a totally reasonable and very, like, I wouldn't have even thought of it. You know, it seems right. Like a pretty minor thing, but, and I guess I always get a certain joy, when, you know, members of the right, who so often like to, tell those of us who are sort of critically engaged with media that we're making too much of things. It's just a movie, blah, blah, blah. You know, when those movies reinforce their politics, you know, a movie does something that doesn't fall in line with their political viewpoint. And then they flip out, you know, I don't know.
Marco Rubio's concerned that people are going to see this movie and not understand that this was an American crew. Like, they will be so confused by the ambiguity that they'll be like, I saw an American flag, everybody was speaking in,
American English.
Midwestern accent. I understand from history that these are Americans, but if I don't see the flag planted, I'm at sea. I just simply don't know where these people are from. I mean, yeah, okay, you know what, Marco Rubio? Cool. You want to make sure that we actually physically see the flag planted, then when we create movies that show, like, Americans doing heinous things, then we got to show the flag there, too, right? Like, if you're going to reckon with the good stuff, you got to reckon with the bad stuff, too. God, why is everybody so got these trash opinions, Carol?
I don't know, Ebony.
And I love the diss, the UN diss, the conservative.
Yeah, exactly. Like, got to get the dig in.
Worse in their minds than a global coalition to, you know, advance, you know, science or, you know, or humankind's, you know, ability to live upon this planet and peace and harmony. Like, there's something so beyond the pale to them about the fact that this might be read, you know, as a non-specifically American mention. Hey, newsflash, Marco Rubio, the moon is not an American state. It's not a colony.
Yeah, no. I'm pretty sure once Armstrong planted the flag on it, that means it's you know, it's officially it's now part of the U.S. I think that's how that works.
If you like it, you got to put a flag on it.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. And lastly, you know, I think Ebony and I would both like to wish a very happy birthday, 54th birthday to the one and only Keanu Reeves, whose birthday was on September 2nd. Keanu, you're a beacon of good things in these dark times, and we are so grateful for you. Thank you, Keanu. Thank you.
So good. Happy birthday, Keanu.
Yes. Keanu and I both
That's
Virgos.
That's fantastic. That is, I'm so glad. You know, I mentioned, I sent you that ping because I was like, let's give a little shout out to Keanu. I know we are both big fans. I wasn't sure that you would actually indulge me. I'm so glad.
I don't think you understand how deep my affection for Keanu is. Not deep enough to get me out to see Destination Wedding this weekend after some of the reviews made it seem pretty uncomfortable. Though, you know, I may catch it if it's on Netflix at some point or try to endure it. But nonetheless, a deep, abiding affection for Keanu Reeves, my fellow Virgo. You know, I think we share a deep spiritual bond because of that.
Absolutely, I have often noted how similar the two of y'all are.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, you could be, you know, siblings. All right, let us move on into the main body of the show. But before that, I want to say that exclusively for our fantastic backers, we have a bonus segment every week. And if you want access to it, along with some other fun perks, you should join our podcast community at d.rip/femfreak. And now let's talk about Mulholland Drive. I am so excited to talk about this movie. In fact, I'm so excited to talk about it. I'm probably going to trip all over myself more than I normally do. So I am offering a preemptive apology to our three listeners.
Yeah.
If you want to know what I truly think about this film and it's not clear after the podcast, hit me up on Twitter. I will DM you my notes and maybe that'll help. You know, some little way. But just a quick summary for those of you who have never seen the film, or maybe people who saw it so long ago you can barely remember it. So I'm just going to grab a short summary from Wikipedia, that bastion of accuracy. So Mulholland Drive is a 2001 neo-noir mystery film written and directed by David Lynch, starring the amazing Naomi Watts, the luminous Laura Herring, Justin Theroux, Ann Miller, Robert Forster. It tells the story of an aspiring actress named Betty Elms, played by Naomi Watts, newly arrived in Los Angeles, who meets and befriends an amnesiac woman recovering from a car accident. The story follows several other vignettes and characters, including a Hollywood film director who's played by Justin Theroux. Some things to know as we get into our conversation about the film is that this was originally conceived of and shot as open-ended and was meant to be a television series. But apparently, once the footage was shown to the television network, they rejected it. And so then David Lynch shot an ending, and it became the film that we know now. But yeah, so it comes out in 2001. The television series, Mulholland Drive, that he shot was filmed in 1999. Lots of stuff to talk about. David Lynch and his sort of, you know, infamous obsession with the 1950s and the way he, you know, sort of utilizes nostalgia in his films. And then obviously the conversations we can have about identity and self and the way those are constructed and presented. So yeah, just like I said, super excited to talk about this movie. Carol,
yeah,
what have you got to say?
Well, I mean, so you said you might get a little, you know, tripped up. And I think with a film that's as dreamlike in its logic as this one that defies kind of standard discussion, really, it makes it that much easier to get tripped up when talking about it, because there's so many ways of looking at this film, so many different lenses through which to consider it. But I'll start by saying that I got the feeling watching this film this time that maybe that in reckoning with Hollywood the way that he does in this film, you know, Lynch is very, very much about his films very much have a kind of dream logic to them, and this is no exception. And in fact, it's very explicit about that. You know, when Naomi Watts, as this aspiring actress named Betty from some small town in Ontario, arrives in LA, she calls it this, you know, this dream place. And I feel like it's interesting to think about how Lynch's films have often had like an explicitly dreamlike logic to them, but there's also the way in which Hollywood itself is a sort of America's, or even the global, like, dream factory, or the place from which so many of the images that make up our cultural sort of consciousness come from, that you can think of, you know, cinema as a whole, in a way, as the production of dreams in the sense of myths and legends and icons and symbols and things that we, you know, that we carry with us. And I think that Lynch is really, is really interested in that. Okay, so I guess where I want to really start with this film is something that I didn't think about at all the first time that I watched it. This is only my second time seeing the film. So you have the character of she goes by the name Rita, the Laura Herring character, who is amnesiac. She does not remember her name because she's in this very intense car accident at the beginning, and she takes the name Rita from a poster for the film Gilda in this apartment that's starring Rita Hayworth. And it's very deliberate in my mind that the actor from whom the Laura Herron character takes her name is Rita Hayworth, because Rita Hayworth herself was an actor who underwent tremendous image transformation to fit into Hollywood. Rita Hayworth was born Margarita Carmen Cancino. Her father was from a little town in Spain. And initially, she was often cast in roles as the. So this is information that I am taking from her little bio on Wikipedia. But so Rita Hayworth initially was cast in roles as the exotic foreigner, and you know, finally, like on the advice of like studio heads, you know, she took the name. She took her mother's maiden name and became Rita Hayworth. But she had to do a lot. She had to change the color of her hair. She actually had electrolysis to raise her hairline and broaden the appearance of her forehead. So she was really, you know, trying to kind of hide her roots in a sense. And I feel like so the character of Rita in this film, she's Latinx. And I feel like through her... And this transformation that she goes through at one point in the film, she starts donning a blonde wig. She tries to kind of hide her identity. But also they go to this club, Silencio, where you have the singer Rebecca Del Rio sing a really just tremendously powerful and heartbreaking kind of song. And I feel like there's some attempt here to kind of acknowledge or reckon with like the grief of Los Angeles as a place that was kind of itself stolen and transformed into something else and then started kind of excluding or oppressing the very people who kind of established it as a place in the first place. You know what I mean?
That's really interesting. I hadn't thought too much along those specific lines in terms of like Rita Hayworth herself and the construction of her identity, and then, you know, Rita within the body of the film, and then also, you know, Laura Herring herself, who is also Latinx, and I apparently found this out this weekend, was the first Latina named, I think, Miss USA or Miss America back in 1985. I wonder what that says when we consider it alongside the fact that it is Rita who ultimately uses the key to open the box that we then fall into, that, you know, and to inhabit then the real world, right? That it's not Betty, who's been, you know, carrying around the box and the key, but it is Rita who, you know, by any, you know, logical sense, as someone who shouldn't have like an identity and an existence outside of what Diane is, you know, constructing for her within the dream, nevertheless seems to have an existence and an autonomy of her own, and that she is the one who opens that dream box.
Yeah. There's no way anyone who hasn't seen this film is going to, you know, listening to us try to talk about a film of this kind of, again, this kind of dreamlike complexity and intricacy is, you know, is just going to get
oh, you're going to be lost. You're going to be lost. Yeah. But I mean, just from the very beginning, when you hear that people are going to be discussing a David Lynch film, you know, right? You know, like you said, there's a dream logic at play in all of David Lynch's films. There's twists and turns and, you know, nothing sort of progresses linearly in a way that we can understand easily. So, you know, just get into the passenger seat and just take this drive with us down Mulholland Drive. I also want to go back to the idea of the dream and Diane, you know, as we say, played by Naomi Watts, and what it means that in her dream, she is an ingenue, right? So this young, sort of innocent, untouched, yet hopeful figure created by Hollywood to portray something, like what it means that she's finding truth and that she's also finding an escape within her dream, and this very sort of, you know, a Hollywood kind of figure. And I wonder how much it has to do with the difference between female fantasies and male fantasies within the film. So, you know, as we mentioned, like, we both are seeing this film for the second time to talk about it today. One of the things that I was struck by on this viewing that I had not really paid attention to in the first viewing was this, the contrasting between female fantasies and male fantasies in this film. Most specifically through the trope of, like, the girl detective, you know, and versus film noir or literary noir, you know, crime drama, right? Because on the one hand, in female fantasies, and what Diane desperately wants to inhabit is this fantasy of competence and fearlessness and honesty and female closeness. She wants to be needed, you know, she wants to be a very singular sort of person, versus the male fantasy at play in something like film noir, which we also, you know, see those tropes at play in the film. It's about manipulation and overt sexiness and the need to protect women, you know? So I wonder, you know, how much of the dream logic that we're negotiating in this film is about the tension between those female fantasies and male fantasies, or those female dreams and male dreams.
So, right, there's a sort of third act, I guess you could say, to this film, in which it's sort of revealed, I guess, that that everything that's happened up to that point has essentially been a dream, and that Betty is actually this woman named Diane Selwyn, and who is sort of the jilted lover, I believe, of the Laura Herring character, who actually is the star that that, you know, Betty in her dream kind of wanted to be. And I guess, like, for one, I can't help but think about Twin Peaks: The Return. You know, in Twin Peaks, we get this kind of awakening in which it seems to be the case that Agent Dale Cooper, who has been the hero of a sort of the entire series, is actually, in reality, a man named Richard, who is not as chipper and you know, enthusiastic about coffee and pie as his dream figure is. And I think there's a similar relationship between Diane, the real, you know, Betty, and the Betty, the dream figure, in that, yeah, that Betty is able to inhabit those kinds of wide-eyed ingenue dreams of, oh, I'm just going to come to Los Angeles from far away. I'm going to get off the plane, and, like, almost immediately I'm going to be taking auditions. I'm going to be knocking people out in auditions. I'm going to be, you know, I'll shot at, like, really big parts, when, you know, in reality, she, like most people who come to LA with any hopes of getting into acting, like, is lucky if she gets kind of small bit parts, or, you know, works as an extra, a background actor or something. And she kind of exists in the shadow of other people.
One of the things that I was struck by anew watching this film for the second time is how assured Naomi Watts' performance is, both as Betty and as Diane, and the incredibly strong demarcation between the two women. And so this is the film that kind of, you know, thrust Naomi Watts onto the scene. And thank God it did, because she is both so utterly authentic as Betty and as Diane. It's almost incomprehensible to see someone, you know, kind of display two radically different kinds of physicality. It's not just about her appearance. And so, you know, we have the very kind of prim and proper late 1990s version of the 50s.
Right.
Kind of costuming that she has with Betty, where she wears, you know, kind of buttoned up sweaters, and she's got a very, you know, correct kind of string of pearls and this, you know, adorable kind of bob haircut, versus the messy, greasy hair, and you know, tank tops that she wears as Diane, but also the way that she holds her body, the weariness in her eyes, all of it is so utterly believable thanks to what Naomi Watts is able to do. And I think it is both, you know, a testament to her skill, but also the very skillful direction of David Lynch, because through that performance, we again see that comment on Hollywood and how it transforms people from the inside out. To allow them to be able to survive.
Yeah.
And, you know, in this space that is ultimately, you know, very destructive.
Yeah, I think there's a deep concern in this film with what Hollywood does to women, both in the direct sense of women who come to Hollywood and try to make it as actors, but also in the larger sense of the impact that the images that Hollywood churns out might have on women more generally. But there's a fascinating scene in which a number of men are in this kind of boardroom. And it really, I think, illuminates or touches on the ways that women are kind of deconstructed and commoditized by Hollywood, because you have, a manila envelope that's passed around with a woman's headshot in it, right? And for whatever reason, this sort of mob conglomerate or something like has
Dan Hedaya's.
Yeah, Dan Hedaya, the great. Yeah. You know, has decided that that a particular actress must get this lead role in the film, and you know, and there's a lot of kind of strong arming of the director Justin Theroux. Perhaps my favorite part of that scene is just this moment when it's like the Castigliani brothers or something like that. The mob brothers, like one of them is. He orders an espresso and they bring him an espresso, and you can tell that everyone in the room is just terrified of how he's going to react, because obviously they've been down this road before. And he sips the espresso, and it's like he goes into convulsions. It's so awful to his palate, you know, that he spits it out. And the terror in the room, like there's just so much menace in that moment of like, oh my God, we didn't get the espresso right. You know, it's palpable, the kind of fear, because these men wield so much power, and they, you know, it seems that they in some sense are kind of controlling, or there's definitely men in shadowy rooms, you know, controlling and pulling strings in Hollywood to kind of make the decisions that really shape the movies, right?
Yeah, that scene that you're talking about with the espresso.
Yeah.
And this, you know, kind of ludicrous like the amped up tension in that room is taken to an absurd level, you know, and almost played for laughs. In the same way that then as Adam, the director's life starts to rapidly unravel when he drives home and finds that his wife has been cheating on him with Billy Ray Cyrus. In the way she, you know, acts as if he's done something wrong by coming home. And then his response is to take her jewelry and pour, you know, pink paint all in it and whatever. And then, you know, he goes to this Fleabag hotel and then is directed to meet a figure called the cowboy later. The whole trajectory of Justin Theroux's arc in the first, you know, half of the movie is marked by this kind of cartoonishness that is read one way as we are watching the movie straight through for the first time, right? And then we sort of map what it means after we learn that Betty is actually Diane and Rita is actually Camilla, and that figures like the cowboy or these over-the-top mob figures are stand-ins who are necessary to punish Adam for taking Camille. And so that kind of like, you know, over-the-top, you know, violence that he has to, is either threatened with or has to suffer is all is all Diane, right? And that's some, there's something so interesting about that, that, you know, this woman is using the tools of other men to punish a man for taking her girlfriend from her.
I do love Diane's kind of vindictive jealousy, as we see it in that final act where Camilla is getting married to the Justin Theroux character in reality, and they have this, you know, little moment where the two lovebirds kind of toast to each other with Diane right there, and they say, like, here's to love. And just like the way that Naomi Watts is just like shooting daggers with her eyes at them because of the jealousy and the heartache, the heartbreak that she has gone through losing Camilla, you know, as she herself kind of joins in the toast and says, here's to love. Like, I mean, I think that the jealousy of women as a threat, as a force of danger, is definitely something that we see throughout a lot of film noir, right? The motivations of women that lead them to do things that that cast men and sometimes other women into really dangerous situations are often fueled by jealousies and things. So was an interesting
The reveal, after we've gone into the blue box and come out into reality, and Diane is trying to, you know, adjust to not being Camilla's partner anymore, but, you know, is still in, you know, close contact with her. And Camilla invites her to some party. As she gets out of the car on that long driveway up to Adam's house in the Hollywood Hills, Camilla comes to get Diane, and they walk through this small wooded area, and it's very much this sort of Eve in the Garden kind of imagery. And I think I love the way, well, love probably is not the word I want to use here, because I was actually, I spent some time wondering how I felt about it, but I just thought it was so striking how the way that Camilla is, like, the colors that she wears, right? It's primarily like blacks and reds throughout the film. But the way that she becomes a figure of menace and duplicity once we are back in the real world. And so there's absolutely this kind of film noir insistence upon the manipulative woman, the vixen, the femme fatale. But those stories, those tropes predate it, you know, by thousands of years. And so, as I said, you know, you have this very, like, you know, Eve-like imagery with Camilla in this form-fitting, flowing black and red dress as she grabs Diane by the hand and escorts her up the mountain, you know, as if to pull her into that world and pull her into sin. I also thought it was interesting that, like, her makeup becomes more pronounced and much heavier in the real world as well, as we start to learn more about, you know, who Camilla actually is, and learn that she's false in a way. Her feelings for Diane, such as they were never as deep as Diane's herself. And you know, she is someone who clearly is willing to pursue pleasure for her own ends at whatever cost.
Yeah. While women themselves in this film may at times be duplicitous and dangerous, I still feel like this is really a fascinating film about how Hollywood what Hollywood inflicts on women, and like the trauma in a sense of being women, like, in Hollywood. There's an audition scene during the whole dream part of the film where Betty goes to audition, and it's this intensely kind of sexual scene, and like, for me that scene is extremely uncomfortable, because I feel like Betty sort of understands that she has to sexualize herself and sexualize the scene as much as possible to get the part, right? And I feel like that is the way that Hollywood so often works, right? That women are viewed, are objectified, and are in pretty much any, almost any context, you know, if you cannot deliver the goods as a, as an object of desire, then very often you're kind of, you know, invisible or worthless. You're not what we're looking for.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. And, you know, the actress that the mob guys are trying to get into that lead role, we see that she actually is quite talented. It's not, you see that it's all, it's a matter of luck. It's a matter of who you know. It's a matter of how well you fit into the boxes that have been placed before you. But it's so little has to do with who you are as a person.
Right, right. Yeah. Betty in the dream, you know, she is really only able to get those ins and to start kind of taking auditions and stuff like immediately after arriving in LA because she has connections to the industry through her aunt. And we all know like the acting dynasties that are so commonplace in Hollywood. Like, obviously, of course, if your dad was James Brolin, you have a better chance of being Josh Brolin than if you're some nobody who comes to Hollywood from, you know, wherever, right? I mean, obviously, that still happens, but so many people in Hollywood, I think more than most people realize, are in the positions they're in because they, you know, are somebody's kid or somebody's cousin or somebody, you know, whatever. Like, those connections. Nicolas Cage is like, I don't know, Francis Ford. I don't know. You know, whatever. This is, it's all connected, right? It's all connected. It's a conspiracy.
Well, as I have said, I believe that, you know, there are too many Maras out there acting. I think that we should have, as a, you know, voting public, should have been able to voice how many Maras we wanted on our screens. That never happened. So, yeah, you know, as hard as that industry is, to know that it's going to be hard for anyone who doesn't have those connections, and it has nothing to do with you. It has absolutely nothing to do with you. Before we move on into what's your freak out deal, I want to ask about something that people always talk about when they talk about Mulholland Drive. And I've never, granted, I've only seen the movie twice, but I've seen this key scene several times because it's been, you know, YouTube clipped, but also people endlessly talk about it. The figure of that terrifying hobo,
right behind the winkies, the not Denny's on,
I have yet to come up with any kind of coherent meaning for that figure or for those scenes. Caro, can you help me?
No. No, I mean, the only thing that I can think of is sort of along the lines of my earlier statements about how in some ways Mulholland Drive is concerned with Los Angeles as a place that was sort of was claimed by those who did not create it and who remade it into something that sells and perpetuates their own image, the image of white people through cinema, like, you know, that it sends around the world, that figure, you know, this figure who seems like a extremely, you know, poverty-stricken, homeless kind of individual, you know, maybe in some way is also a reflection of that, of the ways in which of the grief or the sorrow of the things that fall through the cracks in Los Angeles because of the ways in which the city has been taken by those who did not create it. But I think that, you know, I think that David Lynch operates very much on a dreamlike level. I really don't believe, and this is, again, I don't have any way of knowing this for a fact, but I really don't believe that he creates art with some sort of notion of everything having a specific meaning. He may not even know what it means himself. So I think that it's one of those things, and that's part of what makes Lynch's work so fascinating. It's one of those things that can be looked at and interpreted and discussed in so many ways.
So what you're trying to say is you do not have a David Lynch decoder ring?
I don't.
Or do you believe in such an item? Okay,
exactly.
Cool.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm with it.
I
do wonder, I did not know this until fairly recently, but the actor who played that role is an actor named Bonnie Ahrens. And so, yeah, I'm still turning it over in my mind because I do think it's important that it's a woman playing that particular role. I'm just not sure why yet. Also, part of me just, it feels sad for Bonnie Ahrens because she is constantly playing these roles where her physicality is first and foremost in the creator's mind, and it's about her looking weird. And that's got to be a weird life to have, you know? Like,
yeah.
That's why you get hired. Anyway, moving on, although I have a feeling I'm going to want to return to some of these items in the bonus, let us do a little something we call What's Your Freakout? Caro, what are you freaking out about?
My freakout this week is the ongoing cultural rehabilitation of George W. Bush.
Nope, not having it.
Yeah, you know, gosh, did you see how at McCain's funeral he passed like a mint to Michelle Obama, and it was just so cute. It was just so cute. It was such a touching, sweet moment. Oh my God, you know, I stand for George W. Bush. No, it's really a problem. It's really a problem that we as a nation, I think, have such a short moral memory, and that we lack moral conviction collectively, such that we're able to just see, you know, a little moment of humanity occur, and then I understand. Look, I get it that Trump is overtly hateful and overtly, you know, racist and things in ways that George W. Bush never was. But just because George W. Bush can get up on stage at McCain's funeral and talk about the importance of, like, civility and how, you know, and kind of take swipes at Trump by praising McCain, like, we cannot forget or forgive or, you know, erase the tremendous, you know, war crimes and death toll that that, you know, George W. Bush as president was responsible for. Like, it, you know, to an extent, it, you know, it doesn't, like, yes, Trump's hateful rhetoric matters. It matters very, very, very much. But we have to understand that's not the only thing that matters, and that presidents who, I mean, obviously George W. Bush was mocked endlessly for his, you know, inability to put together a coherent sentence when he was president, but he wasn't cruel in his language, you know, in the way that Trump so often can be. But we have to realize that presidents, you know, powerful people can be on the surface charming and, you know, nice, pleasant, you know, human, warm in their interactions with others, and still be responsible for some of the most heinous, you know, reprehensible acts in history. And we want to forget that with George W. Bush, and we can't. We mustn't. It's very important that we remember that he is not a good person, and that we should not find it cute and adorable and stuff when, you know, he passes Michelle Obama a mint. Like, I don't give a fuck. You know, he could paint the cutest, you know, painting of teddy bears that anyone's ever seen, and it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. You know, he's not your sweet, you know, grandpa. He's responsible for tremendous evil in the world. Okay,
yeah.
Remember that.
I people, we have to set some higher standards for ourselves. The bar is so low that we are effectively tripping on it. I'm here, here, Carol, to everything you said. I don't care if George W. Bush is, you know, nice to his family or to other wealthy, powerful people. You know, like, what are you doing to the least of these? Dude, like, what? I'm never gonna hang out with the dude, so I don't care how fun he is to hang out with. I need more. And the idea that it took so little time for us to forget what he was responsible for, what he oversaw, what he helped to coordinate, you know, what he is responsible for ushering into being simply because he looks like Alfred E. Noop. No, we're not doing this. We're doing this.
Yeah.
Lord. Okay, so my freak out, excuse me. What's your deal? What's your deal?
What's your deal?
What's your deal? What's your deal? What's your deal? My deal for the week. I get to do this so infrequently. I got to take every opportunity.
Savor it.
So what's my deal?
Savor it, Ebony. Yeah.
A show called Claws. So do you know this show, Caro?
I've never heard of it. No.
Okay. So it is a show on, I want to say on TNT. It debuted last year. It's in its second season. Actually, I believe the second season just wrapped up. So created by Elliot Lawrence and showrun by a woman named Janine Sherman Barwa. It is a show about a woman played by Niecy Nash, who is a black woman in her mid-40s, plus size. And I bring all of this up because it's so important to the presentation of her character, who runs a nail salon in Florida. And it's about the relationship she has with her employees, with the lovers that she takes during the course of the show, with her brother, who is played by the actor Harold Perrineau, and who is autistic on the show. So just on that level, the fact that you have this multiracial cast, that you have a lead character who is an older woman, that she does not inhabit the sort of body that Hollywood typically allows us to see on our screens. On that level alone, it would be great. We're getting something new, right?
Yeah.
But then the show throws a bunch of funhouse confetti into the mix. This show is so interesting to watch, and I don't want to suggest that there are no hiccups and there are no problematic elements. So like I said, Harold Perrineau, for instance, plays Dean, Niecy Nash's brother, autistic brother. Harold Perrineau is not autistic himself. Come on, y'all. Own voices, own representations. We got to stop doing this. We got to stop having autistic actors playing autistic roles. Like, we got to stop, right? And there's some things that go on with regards to race, you know, sort of like the casual racism that infects so much of our daily lives that we don't even notice it, you know? So there's a character played by Karrueche Tran, and I'm probably mispronouncing her name, but she is this wonderful young actor. She started off in modeling. Many people know her because she used to date Chris Brown, poor girl. But she is mixed race, Asian and black. And so sometimes the kind of casual racism that falls out of other characters' mouths regarding her Asian background is very upsetting, right? But what the show, I think, is careful to do is let us know that although Desna, played by Niecy Nash, is our perspective character, not everything she does is worthwhile, moral, or valuable. So the show, as I said, is about her relationships with the women she works with, about her relationship with her brother, with the various men she's attached to. But it's also about her life as a cleaner for, like, cleaning money laundering for the Dixie Mafia.
Okay? What?
So, yo, Carol, this show is banana soup on every level. It's like if I wrote a Carl Hiaasen novel, okay? So just like the larger-than-life, grand guignol kind of Southern figures. And not just Southern, but Florida Southern. You know, the candy colored imagery in this film of these women who, despite being larger than, you know, a Hollywood six, nevertheless love their bodies and are unafraid to display their bodies for their own pleasure. you know?
Yeah.
I absolutely loved it. It reminds me of the way that Dolly Parton has always talked about her look and about the development of, you know, a particular kind of glamour that she embraced and how, like, class was inextricably linked to what she understood as beauty. I just think there's so much interesting stuff going on in this show, you know, in regards to like female friendship, intimacy, you know, self-reliance. There's stuff like oh my gosh, I can't get too into it because I'm going to spoil it. But if you have not checked it out, watch an episode or two. And I promise you, you will be like, I got to find out what's going on. I got to watch more of this because it is straight up cuckoo ca-choo.
Well, you've convinced me, Ebony. I will definitely give it a look.
Excellent. Excellent. All right. And now, Anita's not here, but what we do have is a listener freak out. So we are going to play you a freak out from listener Kristen Ritter of Alaska.
Hi, this is Kristen Ritter from Alaska, and I'm freaking out about a French film by actress and director Eleonore Poirier called I Am Not an Easy Man. I Am Not an Easy Man tells the story of a womanizer who hits his head and wakes up in a world where women are the dominant social class. What is so special about this film is that it creates this rich, fully immersive world full of images of what a society might look like if women weren't second-class citizens, and it pays incredible attention to detail. The movie touches on everything from fashion and beauty to housework to careers to the language we use to talk about gender and the assumptions we make. Getting to live in a world where women are the prime movers, where they hold the highest offices in every field, feel comfortable in their clothes and bodies, and enjoy unparalleled social benefits is a treat, even if it only lasts for a few hours. I can't recommend this movie highly enough. It's streaming on Netflix now. Thank you.
Thanks, Kristen. And, you know, if you are interested in sharing your views and your freakouts and your deals with the world, you can submit your own freakout and it might make it onto the show. Just head over to femfreak.com/freakout. That's FREQOUT. All right, that's our show. You can catch us back here every single Wednesday. And remember that you too can join our podcast community and help us bring Feminist Frequency Radio to you every single week at d.rip/femfreak. And hey, if you are enjoying the show, please rate and review us on iTunes and tell your friends too. You can check out all of our work and our other podcasts at feministfrequency.com. So be sure to follow us on Twitter at FemFreak to stay up to date on all the news. You can find us on Twitter. Anita is at Anita Sarkeesian. I am at Hobo Dumpster. Carol, where are you?
See, yours should always go last because it's weird for you to do your joke.
Do you want another one? I'll give you another one.
My normal answer, but I'm at Carolyn Michelle.
I am also at Just Call Me Coco. Everybody does. Mm. Our producer is Phil Circus, who also composed our theme music. We got technical support by Sarah Norales and art by Jamie Varon. We will see you all next week.
Later, y'all.
Bye.